We're going to turn to our first panel for the day, and the focus of this panel is on the hidden realities of work in low-wage jobs. Each of the panelists have investigated jobs in a particular industry, retail, restaurants, and nursing homes, and I think their work very much exemplifies research that contributes to the big picture of what is taking place in the labor market, as well as to the understanding of the everyday practices that can complicate the lives of workers and families and potentially undermine the effectiveness of public policies. Jennifer Swanberg from the University of Kentucky will get us started. Her talk focuses on jobs in a retail chain. Next will be Elaine Waxman, who is a doctoral student here at SSA, who will talk about her research on opportunities for workers in department stores and distribution centers. Then Kim Klum, who is a newly minted PhD from the University of Michigan, will present her qualitative research that she's completed of jobs in nursing homes. And last but not least, Anna Haley Locke, who is currently at the University of Washington, will present findings from her comparative study of restaurant jobs under different policy contexts. Following our panelists, Aitza Citron, who is a program officer at the Russell Sage Foundation and a graduate of SSA's master's program, will lead us in discussion.
Ah, great. Good morning. Susan, thank you, and Julia, thank you for putting on such a fantastic symposium. It seems that the people that you've gathered here today is unprecedented, and hopefully our work will continue to spur change both within organizations and public policies and improve the lives of the people that are in these jobs. I think most of us in this room recognize that the quality jobs for workers most of us in this room recognize that quality jobs for all workers is just the right thing to do. However, getting businesses to change current workplace practices is, as we all recognize, complicated and difficult. And unless we begin to create kind of the business case for making change, this change will come ever so slowly, especially in this economy. The research that I'm going to present today is from a project that we call the City Sales Study. City Sales is a large retail firm who opted not to be named. And what we've been trying to do in this study is to really develop the business case for why quality jobs matter and to create and to develop a series of analyses that look at how quality jobs are both good for the individual and good for the employer. But before I get started, I want to acknowledge my co-PI in this project, Jacqueline James from the Center on Work and Family at Boston College, and publicly thank our research team who really made this project come to light. And I also want to thank the Ford Foundation and the Center on Aging and Work for their generous support of the research that I'm going to present. So I was instructed by Susan to not give a lot of background because I think there's kind of a recognition that we all understand low-wage work here in the United States. But I think just to kind of give us a little bit of a running start, I think we all recognize that the quality of low-wage jobs in retail settings is poor. In addition to poverty-level wages, the number of hours scheduled per week may vary. Employees receive oftentimes little notice of their weekly schedule, and typically employees have very little control over when they're going to be working. Many of the scholars here today have been studying organizational practices and how it impacts individuals and their families. Some of the work that I've been interested in recently is really looking at how workplace flexibility, this concept of workplace flexibility, fits within this paradigm of what we call job quality. And for work-life scholars, posit that access to various forms of work we call workplace flexibility helps employees to both manage work and non-work effectively. And there's growing evidence that when it's managed properly, it can be good for business. However, the standard definitions that are often used about workplace flexibility do not seem to apply for low-wage hourly workers. Mainly, the broad definition is how, when, and where people work. And for many people in retail, you don't have a choice on how, when, or where you work. So to this end, the one line of inquiry that we've had within the City Sales Study has to get a better understanding of what is workplace flexibility for low-wage workers in retail, and then to determine where does it fit within the context of a quality job and whether or not it has an impact on employee well-being and also on a concept called employer engagement, which is a concept that businesses use because it's an indicator of business success. So we have kind of three primary questions. One, what is workplace flexibility for hourly workers? I'm going to examine the effects of workplace flexibility on personal well-being and work-family conflict, and then finally examine the effects of workplace flexibility on employee engagement. Like everyone, I'm going to move fast because I know we just have 12 minutes. So the study description, it was City Sales is a large retail firm with over 6,400 stores in the United States. They espouse a culture of responsiveness and adaptability for their low-wage hourly workers. So we went in to really try to figure out what does this mean. We used a mixed method design, and the data that we collected was in three regions of the country in 10 districts and 388 stores. And just so you know, the structure of this organization, there's stores, then districts, and then the retail, then the regions. And that's how they're managed. There were two components to this study, both qualitative study and a quantitative study. Our qualitative study was our first step to truly try to begin to understand what is workplace flexibility for low-wage hourly workers. We interviewed 40, we had face-to-face interviews with 40 district managers and three regional vice presidents. And there's a variety of different questions we focused in, but specific to this study was what is workplace flexibility, what is this concept of responsive workplaces, and then what do they perceive as the business case, if any, of creating a flexible work environment? And then the second part of the study was a quantitative study where we surveyed over 8,000 employees in these 388 stores. We collected slightly over 6,000 surveys, both from professional and low-wage hourly workers. We had a 72% response rate, and as noted there, 73% of the sample is hourly workers. So we had a total sample of about 4,000, slightly over 4,000. For the quantitative component, the research methods, the sample that I'm going to share with you today was among full-time workers who were in hourly positions, employed 1 year or more, and 25 years or older. And the reason why we restricted the sample to that particular dimensions was because we wanted to see what life was like for those individuals for whom this is their primary job, as opposed to people who might be working part-time to put themselves through school or through high school students. As you can imagine, the sample was primarily white women, 45 years or of age. 50% had high school or less. About 60% were partnered. 40% had children under the ages of 18. On average, people worked 37 hours per week. And about 40% earned less than $9.84 per hour. I should say that I can tell you why we use that that amount, but for us, that was the kind of the threshold of poverty wages. We used an expanded kind of measure of what was we considered poverty wages. So some of the first findings. There were four primarily forms of what flexible work practices are among this particular company, and we've grouped them into four broad categories. First is schedule preferences, which is allowing employees to have some say about their work schedule. And I know this seems very commonsensical, but when you think about, we have to operationalize what it means in order to understand it. So there's two types of preferences. One, for giving people preferences for specific days, shifts or hours, or preference for a specific routine, like I'd like to work every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, or I can work nights. Then there's the second, which is pre-planned schedule modifications. And what this suggests is that that once the schedule is made, but it's not yet that week, you can actually give opportunities. This is where you give opportunities to employees to say, I don't want to work a certain schedule. So you give your preference that what you can work and then what you can't. Then there's just-in-time schedule changes, which is permitting employees to request a change to the schedule once it's been set. And this can be either an employee will find another employee to work with them, therefore they lose the hours, or they could shift swap, where they essentially exchange their schedules. And then finally, there's flex place. For employees who might want to continue to work 40 hours, but there's not enough hours in one organization, they will allow them to work in more than one setting. And then there's what they call regional flex place, which is allowing people to work in different areas of the country given family circumstances. I just saw there's 5 minutes, so I'm going to fly. Here what we see is that from the manager's perspective, 90% suggested that there's a business case for workplace flexibility, and that focused on such things as recruitment, retention, customer service, commitment of the employees, and work life. The second part of the study, the quantitative piece, looked at one of the challenges with this study is that we had these standardized measures that we wanted to put in the instrument. And as all of us know who've done workplace-based research, oftentimes businesses will say we want a very short survey. And that happened here. We wanted over 200 items, and they said we had to have only 100, of which 24 were items that they wanted. So needless to say, our standardized items kind of got blown apart. So factor analysis was critical here to make sure that, in fact, we had what we wanted to study. So we did a series of multiple regressions and path analysis, which I'll share with you. But essentially what came out is that there are kind of seven or six dimensions of what we call a quality workplace. Supervisor effectiveness, and I can give you details on what each of these mean later in the interest of time. There were two forms of workplace flexibility that came out of this. Even though we measured all the forms that came out of the individual interviews, the two forms of flexibility were schedule satisfaction and whether or not people had the ability to modify their schedule due to work and family circumstances. The fourth form was kind of job fit and resources, whether or not the job fits people's skills and interests, and do they have the resources on the job to do their job and do it well, opportunities for development, and teamwork. And then we looked, both our regressions and path analysis looked at kind of three primary outcomes, psychological well-being, work-to-family conflict, and then this measure of employee engagement, which looks at three dimensions of an employee's commitment to the job, both on a psychological, cognitive, and an emotional level. And again, I'm happy to share with you details after this. So here's our first kind of path analysis, and I'm going to try to walk you through it in a very simple manner. To go back to the first question of is there a relationship between workplace flexibility, in this instance, two forms of schedule satisfaction and flexibility, does it have a relationship with psychological well-being? Well, you can see here that there's an indirect effect on psychological well-being through the other characteristics of the work environment, and that you see that there's a direct path between the four other factors, job fit, teamwork, opportunities for development, and supervisor effectiveness. And overall, this particular analysis predicted about 16% of the variance of psychological well-being. Continuing with that theme, also one other thing that's important to note, it's a little hard to see, but with supervisor effectiveness, what we began to see is that this is a very critical component to these various outcomes, and that an effective supervisor is one who is able to create an environment where people, where the job is the right fit for the individuals, they have the resources to do their work, there's a culture of teamwork, there's opportunities for advancement, and then there's also access to schedule flexibility. So our second dependent variable, work-life conflict, you begin to see this model's a little more simple. We remove the paths, obviously, that were insignificant. And what we see is that, that these two forms of flexibility have an indirect relationship on work-to-family conflict. The three factors that had direct paths were job fit, teamwork, and supervisor effectiveness. And you could see that there's a negative relationship between these. So when people didn't feel like they were in the right job, they didn't have effective supervisors, or there was not a sense of teamwork, that there was higher levels of work-to-family conflict. And then finally, here's the variable that businesses often use to kind of get a sense of, or as an indicator of business success, employee engagement. So again, with a series of path analysis, the results kind of are very similar. You see similar themes, that schedule flexibility has an indirect relationship, but again, those four factors are critical to employee engagement. So in a very simplistic manner, kind of what this begins to suggest is that that job quality matters. It matters both to the individual and to the employer. And there's another set of analyses that we've been working on which actually looks at this at the store level, and we're able to correlate that with their standardized business outcomes, and we're beginning to see some of the same themes. So I saw the big word end. So in terms of implications, I think we're going to be talking about this all day today, that really quality workplaces matter, and we have to begin to figure out ways that we can change policy and create incentives for businesses to figure out how to do this. And as we move forward in terms of policy discussions, I think we all recognize that there's the paid sick leave, which I think is critical to this group of employees, but then also there's this another set of legislation that's up to kind of discuss flexibility and try, and I think it's called the right to ask, and that gives employees the right to ask for workplace flexibility. And I caution policymakers that when they're putting this forward, that we have to think hard and about this particular population, because as we all know, that right to ask may invariably hurt them as opposed to help them. So thank you.
Good morning. I apologize in advance. I'm battling some respiratory demons, so I hope they will not be restive for the next 15 minutes, but I'm sorry if they are. Okay, so a few years back, seems like ages ago, I was sitting in a local welfare office listening to exhortations being given to women coming off of TANF about the kinds of determination and skills and, you know, if they could just stay with a job, if they could just hang in there, they would make it work. And I thought to myself, wow, I don't believe that. But I was quiet. And so that's really what has informed my research that I've had the pleasure of doing with Susan Lambert and Julie Henley. And that is that, you know, if we have this American story about, you know, rising from the bottom, then what kind of structure of opportunity is really available to people who play the game and who play by the rules? So those have been my research questions, really. How do employer policies and practices, of course, as I'm sure you all know, those can be very different, structure opportunity in lower-level jobs? And how do employees also experience that opportunity? And I think we've had some terrific work in the last several years post-welfare reform about workers, but not as much work, not as much research about this. The nature of work itself or the nature of jobs, as I think would be helpful. And a lot of times also we try to get at the nature of jobs through looking at worker histories and trajectories, and I still think we're missing a fair amount of detail and nuance. So I think jobs are a very important source of social stratification, and being that that's at an all-time high, it's very useful for us to take a harder look at what jobs look like. And also, these are jobs that people stay in. They're not just jobs that people move through, these lower-level jobs. So they're jobs that people expect to or need to support their families on, and we need to know something about them. I'm just going to rocket through some of this. I just want to mention that I think in recent years we've developed some literatures that are helpful to us. For example, the standard and non-standard work literature. But a lot of our early understanding of job organization and structure came from a totally different era. The internal labor market theories and whatnot came from, you know, a manufacturing era, a male-dominated workforce, and I don't think our theory has kept up as well with the changes in the American workforce, and so we owe it to ourselves also to help develop the theory. So what do we mean by opportunity? And this is a huge topic all in itself, but I'm just going to touch on a few things today. Obviously, financial reward is a thing that leaps to people's minds the most, and as has been touched on already, hourly wages is an important part, but also the hours, and the two go together, and it's not enough to say this is a $10 an hour job if you don't know how many hours the person is going to get or if you don't know how much they fluctuate. Health insurance coverage is a very important part of financial reward for most people. And so that's something that I've taken a look at. Mobility. If we believe that people will rise through these jobs, then what structure is there for them to do that? Is there training Are there ladders? Are there what kind of promotion rates do we see? And then finally, there are lots of other dimensions of opportunity and even forms of mobility, like moving laterally into a job that suits you better for any number of reasons. And also, as Jennifer just mentioned, schedule as opportunity, as a meaningful dimension of work, is very important. Just quickly, my information is drawn from two studies, two linked studies here at the University of Chicago. The employer side was directed by Susan Lambert, and it was a comparative organizational analysis. We looked at seven retail work sites in the city of Chicago, and then we also interviewed employees at those work sites, and that piece was under the direction of Julie Henley. So I have very uncreative names for these employers who also don't want to be named. But I'll just quickly tell you, there are really three dimensions of retail. There's call centers, there's stores, brick-and-mortar stores, and then there's distribution centers, which are warehouses that funnel the goods. And they're really very different. So for us to talk about retail, it's important to unpack that. A lot of call centers are not in urban areas, so that was not something we could look at with these particular companies. But we were fortunate that in many cases we could look at both a store and a distribution center. I call them middle, as in middle of the road, a building store, a department store, that would be a higher end, and discount store, self-explanatory. A few years ago, I was giving a presentation, and the presenter right before me said, he was wrapping up his thoughts about low-wage jobs, and he said, well, I just want to say that retail's a total loser and just forget about retail. And I was like, ooh, I have to get up after that. The problem is that almost one in five American workers is associated with the retail industry. So whether or not it's a loser, it's here to stay. And it's many of these jobs are not exportable, and they are very important to our economy. They're cashiers and sales occupations are a major source of growth in the last decade. So we have to think about it. There are relatively low barriers for entry, so in thinking about lower-level workers, it's important to look at the structure of those kinds of industries. And the companies that we're looking at are all top 20, 30 retailers. And so the design choices they make have a lot of bearing on other companies as well. So there are different kinds of jobs, and that's another thing that doesn't get unpacked sometimes when we do work research. There's manual work in both warehouses and in stores, like stocking. That's often more traditionally male-dominated. It has a different character. There's sales and cashier, which is store-based. And then there are clerical or customer service functions, which are present in both distribution centers and in stores. Okay, so reality number one, these are not minimum wage jobs. Not a single one of them that I looked at. The lowest starting wage, this is from 2002-2003, was $6.25 at a discount store. The highest starting wage at the building distribution center was $13.50. Doesn't sound too bad, huh? These are not low wage by many of the research standards that are used. Sometimes people use something around $8. I was glad to hear Jennifer use something a little higher. I think we all need to make a pact to get away from using poverty levels as a standard for research because we know that it's so inappropriate. But anyway, that being said, they don't generally fall in the radar often of low-wage jobs. I don't think you can see this too good, but the point was just to show you, we asked typical pay by job type, and this is also by employer. It ranges, you know, typical pay being, you know, what's your typical employee? Oh my goodness, it's 5 minutes. $7.50 to $13.75. Okay, that's a pretty good span. So right there, if you're an advocate or if you're a job developer or whatever, it's important to look at the type of retail that's out there. It also varies quite a bit by types of jobs. If I'm in retail, I definitely would prefer to be in a distribution center when it comes to just starting wage. It's a significantly higher pay there. And customer service, there's not that many of those jobs, but they do pay better. Okay, wage growth through tenure, if you stick it out, is limited. The typical way to get it is a merit increase that runs 2 to 4%. And so, for example, if you were starting at $7.70 in 2000, and over the course of 4 years after inflation, your increase would be 1.9% of your starting wage or 15 cents. Okay. So we also can look at bands, pay bands, or grades, and see the span there. These are for some non-supervisory jobs. You know, 40 to 70% is all your growth potential anyway, unless you're moving out of this arena. And, you know, employees know this. They're like, you've got to be kidding. I'm 30 years old. I have to supply, you know, my family with their needs, and you expect me to hang in there with you for this kind of increase. So, obviously, if that's the case, you need to move up, theoretically at least. And one of the ways we look at that is we tend to look at rungs on a ladder. Is there a ladder? How many rungs? So on and so forth. It's tricky stuff. So I want to just talk about a few of these. Okay, so in the far right corner, discount store, there's three rungs, okay, for that particular job, a manual job. That sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Three rungs? I mean, that's like an actual ladder. The fact of the matter is, when we talked to both the employer and the employees, two of those almost never get used. So it's really a one-rung job for the most part. All people at that store are hired at the part-time level no matter what. And very few people move out of that rung. So just to ask that piece of information is not helpful unless you dig in. The building distribution center next to it has a one-rung job. They're pretty frank about that. Actually, it's not a one-rung job. They have a warehouse worker, and then they have a team lead. And in most companies, a team lead is actually paid higher, and it's, you know, you're given responsibility for work process, and they recognize that. They don't pay their team leads any different at that distribution center. So it's like a ladder that's, you know, not recognized. But the pay is better, and you have benefits, which you don't have at the first level of the discount store. So it's a little tricky. The middle distribution center in the second column, in the second row there, they have four rungs. And this is a company that actually seems to use them. And particularly in clerical, I seem to have more elaborated rungs for clerical people. So you have data entry, and then maybe later on they're human resource specialists. So there actually is an opportunity for people to move through those jobs. And this particular company did seem to have more of a philosophy of trying to retain and nurture people along. So that, I think, is probably a fairly legitimate ladder. On the sales row down below, there's a little colored box four. That's also an elaborated ladder. You could be a salesperson. You could be what they call a vendor specialist. Okay, so if you go to a large department store and you go to a makeup counter, chances are that person has been co-hired and trained by a national company that provides that makeup. And so that person's, the person who's working behind the counter, their destiny is coordinated by two employers, really. So the department store and the national vendor. This would potentially open up more opportunities. Maybe you can move to different stores that vendor services. Maybe you can move into that vendor company. But that relationship is very complicated because they don't want to upset each other. So in fact, what looks like potential opportunity when you got into the political dynamics was potentially much more limiting. Okay. Most jobs are not designed for vertical mobility, and this is in the words of employers. Basically, 10 to 15% of people may move up. So right from the beginning, they don't expect it. There's one there. You'll see the middle distribution center, 35%. Again, this is, I think, the company that is more committed to, or had been in the past, more committed to sort of lifetime employment. But I'm not sure I totally believe the 35%. I think it's better than most, but I don't totally believe that. Okay, and looking at the employees that I spoke with, most of the employees in our sample were long stayers. You know, they were people who were really trying to hang in there, and they'd been there like 4 years. So they'd had a little bit better rate, but the majority of them still had not experienced vertical promotion. Okay, we don't really have time to go into some cases. You can look at them in your slides, and if you have questions, that's always a fun part, but I have to rocket through it. I'll just say that I want to mention that Kenya actually had been there 23 years, and so when you took her tenure into account, she actually lost a lot of money over time. Okay, this just speaks to Jennifer's work, which is that schedule control was very, very important to Vera, and so she had spent her career actually dodging promotion. She had run through every single job in the store in order to not be promoted because she needed her daytime hours, and if she became a supervisor, she would lose them. So it was like the opposite of what we would expect. And yet for her, that is the most important aspect of opportunity. Okay, supervisory positions may not improve reward. What we heard from people was, gee, they don't really pay that much better. They're a lot of hassle. I lose control over my schedule, and most people didn't have a positive impression of them. Finally, just that these are not living wage jobs, even though they might sound okay. What I did was take the typical pay for distribution centers and for stores, and I, as reported to me by the employer, and I took best case hours, 40 hours, almost nobody gets those, and 30 hours for part-time, and I'll just draw your attention to the fact that basically we're talking federal poverty level when it comes to store, or, you know, at best case, you know, some multiple of poverty, and certainly nowhere near self-sufficiency. Similar findings on the employee side. So finally, if I use the Illinois self-sufficiency standard to look at employee indicators of wages based on the average hours that people told me and average wage that they had. And they don't earn a self-sufficiency wage, and most of them had experienced some significant financial hardship in the prior year. Finally, looked at where they live, because sometimes people will say, oh, well, there's retail jobs. These people have these for extra money, right? That's my favorite one, you know, that women have this for pin money. And so they don't necessarily live in the most poverty-concentrated areas, but they live in above-average poverty areas. Okay, so I was supposed to end like five little cards ago, but thank you for your patience. I just want to say that I think it's very important to look at the structure of these jobs because they only hold so much opportunity. So there's only so much structured in there to begin with, and it's something we need to know. As has already been mentioned, public policy is not designed for the kinds of jobs that we have, and we really have to think hard about workplace development. And I know that somebody said to me recently, you know, job quality is so out. And I was like, okay. The problem is that we can't, even in this economic time, walk away from those kinds of discussions because that's really the crux of much of it. And finally, just my final plea that, yeah, okay, sometimes retail is a loser, but it's way too big to ignore. Thank you.
I'm so glad I get to go after Elaine because Elaine basically just set up all the data for my talk, so I really, really appreciate you doing all that work on my behalf. The title of my talk today is There's Never Enough Overtime, The Limitations of Single Mothers' Reliance on Workplace-Based Strategies to Supplement Low Wages. But before I begin, I just again want to thank both Julie and Susan for putting together this symposium. This is just such a great opportunity, and I'm really so excited to be here today and to be among a lot of people whose scholarship I've really relied on over the years. So for me, it's pretty thrilling. So this presentation is based on my dissertation and based on field work that I did for my dissertation, and I just want to give, again, another note of gratitude to the National Poverty Center, who were generously supported me during that period, and also the University of Michigan School of Social Work. Oh, sorry. This is my research is in a nursing home. I hit this slide a little early, but just to give you a visual, this is not the nursing home that I studied. I just thought you'd like to have a visual of, like, a nursing home. Say it again. That's right. That's the giveaway. Right. So my talk today focuses on a group of workers and a group of women who at first glance might seem to be beating the odds. By most measures, this group is better off than many of their counterparts, better off than many of those who similarly would be categorized as low-wage workers and single mothers. The group I'll be talking about today consists of single mothers who are employed as certified nursing assistants, or CNAs, at a care facility in southeastern Michigan. These were women I met between 2004 and 2005 during the 15 months I conducted ethnographic research at the nursing home where they worked. And I call, not this nursing home, but I call the nursing home where I did my research Rolling Meadows. So all the names in my presentation are fictitious. fictions. But in many ways, these women really represented an exceptional group. Although they're single mothers with only high school degrees, they had secured jobs of higher quality than the ones we were just hearing about in some ways, because the jobs they had secured were paying... they offered a starting wage of $10.34 an hour, which was in 2005 dollars, and within 3 years, their wages rise to $11.43 an hour. So those wages put them slightly above the national average for nursing assistant jobs in 2005, which I'll just show you. And they also put them well above the national average for other kinds of service sector jobs, such as child care worker, food service worker, and retail, which, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, in 2005, those national averages were between $7.40 and $8.89. So these women have really, within the low-wage labor market, these women have really secured better-paying jobs than average. And not only were their jobs better-paying than what we often consider low-wage jobs, these jobs were actually of pretty good quality. They provided the women with health care insurance, and they also provided them, unlike jobs, for example, in retail that we were just hearing about, they provided them with permanent set schedules. So they had a lot of control over their scheduling. Yet, even with all this, especially with the wages being higher than average, but even with the other aspects of their jobs that would be considered good quality, when I was doing my research there, one of the most immediate things that really struck me was how hard these women were struggling. So these women were doing better than many other low-wage workers, and yet they were still suffering considerable and ongoing financial difficulties, and in many cases, severe ones. So even on the wages of their good low-wage jobs, they weren't earning enough to make ends meet often, at which they couldn't adequately maintain their households or meet their children's needs. Or to be more precise, the gap between what they were earning in their jobs and the cost of living, having to pay market-based cost of living, that gap was too great for them. So as a result, many of the women that were working at this nursing home, many of the single mothers who were employed in these SENA jobs, they would regularly experience things like utility shutoffs, which was frequently phone service disconnection was like that could be happening every other month. I mean, at the job, the phone sheets for that kept track of everybody's permanent phone numbers had to be updated every 3 months because everybody's phone numbers changed so frequently. So they would have utility shutoffs, but they also would have creditors' legal actions. So creditors would be contacting them at work to try to track down unpaid bills. They had a lot of transportation difficulties, broken down cars that they couldn't afford to repair, even times when they couldn't afford to put gas in their cars. And they also couldn't afford much in the way of formal childcare arrangements because they couldn't afford the market cost of childcare. So they had to put together a patchwork of some formal care but a lot of informal care. And those arrangements required a lot of energy to maintain and were often subject to breakdowns, which then also impacted their work. But the fact that these chronic financial difficulties and in some cases crises were such an ongoing reality for these women reflects a number of the things that we've been hearing about, but a number of kind of realities about the low-wage labor market. And as I said, we've heard some of this already, but it reflects for one of the things it reflects is the degree to which, as Elaine really pointed out, the wages have really stagnated, you know, for decades in the low-wage labor market while the cost of living has not and has accelerated, especially cost of housing. Even in the face of this big kind of bust in the housing market, it's still the differential gap is enormous. And the other one, of course, is market-based cost for childcare, which has really accelerated. But besides that gap, it also tells us something about the changing nature of work. So again, as Elaine set up so well for me, it tells us a lot about the ways in which the global restructuring of manufacturing and the diminished opportunities for entry-level public employment have transformed low-wage entry-level jobs from ones that could potentially serve as a ladder up to ones that go nowhere, instead offering very limited opportunities for occupation and wage mobility. But what I'm actually going to focus on today is another truth that I think these women's experiences and struggles show us, which is that it really shows us the paradoxical role that the low-wage workplace can play, in relation to these financial difficulties. Because even though, on a literal sense, these low-wage workplaces are the source of low wages, they're also a source of short-term strategies that single mothers often rely on to kind of temporarily, partially remedy their insolvencies. And this is particularly true in the case of overtime, which at the workplace that I was at, overtime was a very frequently used strategy especially by single mothers, to supplement their basic wages. So drawing on the data that I collected from my study of Rolling Meadows, I'll just go back to your visual, of Rolling Meadows, I'm going to talk about the use of overtime to ask us to consider some of the complicated consequences of obligating low-income single mothers to rely so heavily on market-based resources and remedies to meet their families' needs. So as I mentioned, I spent 15 months collecting data at the nursing home and also in the surrounding community. That included, so I was based in the nursing home, but then I also spent a lot of time hanging out with several of the single mothers who worked there, and so I'd spend time with them during their non-work hours, like doing errands and watching TV and watching children. But during the days that I was at Rolling Meadows, I spent most of my time with the scheduling coordinator, a woman who was named Jo, who is she was the person who dealt with all the nursing care scheduling and staffing issues around schedules. So I sat with her and followed her around, like really shadowed her day by day. So she kind of really was my way in. The nursing home itself is located in Ann Arbor, just outside of Ann Arbor, Michigan, and it's a continuing care facility, so it has independent living, assisted living, and then a full care nursing home that had both rehabilitative units as well as a long-term units and a unit for people with cognitive deficiencies or deficits. But I focused, I was just in the nursing care facility, and the nursing care facility had 163 residents, and all told, there were 212 staff members who worked for the nursing care center, and that covers the range of everybody who's doing like housekeeping to doing the food service, and then doing nursing care, which is both the nurses as well as the nursing assistants. So 60 of the staff members were nursing assistants, and then 24 of those 60s were single mothers. And the staff was really diverse. About half of them were not white, and the largest percentage of the not white staff were African American, but then there were a lot of immigrants from Central America, the Philippines, and from Africa. So just to quickly, I won't go into this really actually, but I did, besides doing participant observation, I also did 32 interviews, and then I also analyzed a lot of the documents that were available, and I focused on the single mother's experiences both at home and at work, but then their interactions between the workers and the supervisors, and then a lot of the decision-making and the both the informal and the formal policies and practices. But one of the first things I learned besides the degree to which people were struggling was that Rolling Meadows, the nursing home, was actually chronically understaffed. They didn't have enough staff on their permanent schedule to cover all their unit hours. So as a result, they were constantly asking people to do overtime. So there were a lot of options to do overtime at Rolling Meadows. But this worked out really well because there was a lot of demand for overtime. There were staff who came down to Jill's office like the very day that the monthly schedules were put out on the floor so that they could sign up for their desired overtime shifts. And some of these staff complained really bitterly if they weren't able to get their customary allocation of extra shifts. The fact that there was such high demand for overtime was actually very commonly acknowledged among management. And because workers' desire for overtime was so regular and persistent, in some cases management knew they could get away with being understaffed. They knew that they could bank on regularly stretching existing staff to make up for the labor deficit that would otherwise exist. And I'll just quickly tell you just a very brief illustration of this was there was one of the single mothers. Single mothers were some of the most kind of chronic overtimers in some ways, and one of the most extreme of these was a woman that I called Jenny. And she was a single mother who actually lived in Detroit. She had to commute from Detroit, which is a 45-minute commute between where she lived and the nursing home. And so on an ideal day, that was 45 minutes, but often it was longer. And she had a 14-year-old son at home, so it was just her and her son who lived together at home. And she was regularly picking up double shifts. So that meant like 2 8-hour shifts back to back, which would mean at minimum she was away from home for 18 hours. So there was one period that I tallied her overtime for several pay periods, and she hit over 80 hours a week for 3 weeks in a row. In November and December of 2004, she didn't take a single day off, and many of those days she was working a double shift. You know, Jill once commented that it's amazing that Jenny's still standing up given how many shifts she picks up. Towards the end of December, however, Jenny actually came into Jill's office and asked very unexpectedly for a day off the next day, which was, you know, not normal procedure. But but she told Jill that she needed to take her son to a psychiatrist because he'd been expressing thoughts of suicide, and one of his teachers had contacted Jenny saying he needed to be evaluated by someone professionally. So at the time, I thought, okay, right, she has this big family crisis. She's going to have to really change her overtime patterns, but she didn't. And in fact, even into several months into January or into 2005, she was still picking up very consistently high levels of overtime. And what I came to realize was that as I learned more about her situation, was that she was on the verge of losing her house. And so she had these like dual kind of crises, the one with her son, but at the same time the one of being verging on being homeless. So you know, it's really obvious that single mothers who depended on overtime, like Jenny and like many of the other single mothers at Rolling Meadows, their need for overtime really benefited Rolling Meadows because of their financial situations. They were really willing to pick up these shifts that would have otherwise been unfilled. And this allowed Rolling Meadows to kind of really manage its labor needs very flexibly and manage labor costs in some ways very flexibly. It also allowed them to maintain, you know, state law regulated staff to patient ratios. So in a sense, management really benefited from the fact that their lower level workers had persistent financial needs that their regular wages couldn't cover. Yet, as it did for Jenny, relying on these workplace-based strategies could entail significant costs for many single mothers, costs that call into question its desirability and sustainability as a means to make ends meet. And in conclusion, because I'm over my time, I'm sorry, I argue that there are a number of drawbacks to relying on something like overtime as a way to supplement low wages. When our public policies compel women to rely more heavily on workplace-based remedies rather than public or governmental ones, we have to recognize that these remedies are governed by a very particular logic, the logic of what best serves interests of management. So for a start, these remedies, even, for example, like overtime, are only available to the degree that they serve management's interests. And while they can be more or less humanely administered and responsive to workers' needs, and they're often really of critical value in allowing workers to address immediate crises, they don't do anything to alter the underlying conditions that help fuel these crises in the first place. And furthermore, the financial benefit they provide can come with significant costs for single mothers' home lives, as these extra shifts, for example, require additional time away from their children. And finally, such remedies by giving women the often illusory hope that there's something they can do by working harder, by working longer hours, to somehow transcend the otherwise intractable gap between their earnings and their cost of living may have the effect of encouraging workers to view their economic and social struggles in isolation as individual private issues rather than outcomes of collective and structural circumstances.
This is a distinct pleasure. I am so pleased to be here. My previous associations with this lobby, this grand place, have included sipping champagne when I graduated from the master's program. When I graduated from the doctoral program, I was chasing a toddler, so there's a little less champagne going on there. And then also hearing President Obama, before he was a U.S. senator, address a group in this lobby. So this is a lovely new association to have. Well, today I'm going to present. Oh, well, I'm not yet. How do I? Sorry. Okay. Oh, great. Okay, so today I'm presenting results from my restaurant employment study as a way to convey some of the realities facing one category of lower skilled, lower wage work, restaurant wait staffing in low-end full-service restaurants. The study takes an organizational and job-focused approach going into firms to investigate employer practices there. And it also considers how those practices interact with public employment policies and broader safety net programs. To note, my last slide, I'm going to kind of cover myself up front here, covers some degree of pie-in-the-sky policy directions that my findings suggest. I'd like to think in this era, maybe not pie-in-the-sky, although with economics, probably pie-in-the-sky. If I run short of time, I'm probably going to jettison those, given that there's a later session and the rest of the day is dedicated to thinking about policy strategies. So I may skip that one. So the motivation for this study was threefold. I sought to add to the growing literature of lower-skilled, low-wage work, all of us in the room are on that same page. I also wanted to investigate some of the interplay between private employer practices and public employment policy. I think that how employers structure jobs is always policy relevant. But in this case, I wanted to look at how specific public policies shape and are perhaps shaped by employer practices. And I hope to inform ways that we might improve the quality of lower-level work through public as well as private mechanisms. That is, by observing how variation in working conditions aligns with employer practices and public employment policy, we might gain insights about effective public and private strategies for improving those conditions. So really briefly, a bit about my theoretical framings. A range of literature has sought to explain variation in employment conditions of comparable jobs, net of economic, labor market, and industry conditions they also face. In this study, I focused on two established accounts, the potential roles of organizational business strategy and external regulative forces in shaping employer practices. With respect to business strategy, these are the decisions by firms, as have been alluded to already today, to differentiate on quality and thus engage in more supportive, high investment employment practices, kind of the high road set, versus cost and pursue more low road cost minimizing practices. Even among cost minimizers, some may adopt short-term orientations to saving on labor costs and others more long-term. In this study, I considered the business strategy account by investigating differences in job conditions at sites of two U.S.-based low-end restaurant chains. Now, with respect to the external forces, I drew on neo-institutional theory, which claims that a range of regulative or normative elements outside the walls of firms can critically shape employment relations within them. These include employment laws, as well as prevailing notions of the ways that things should be done. I also turned to the literatures on comparative welfare states and minimum wage laws to shape this part of the accounts that I looked at. In this study, I considered the external forces account by investigating differences in job conditions across or in chain sites located in two states in the United States with disparate minimum wage laws, and also in Canada with a safety net approach distinct from the U.S. model. So the study questions, the main ones, I sought to address two. What are the conditions of frontline restaurant work, focusing particularly on waiter jobs, although I collected data on all of them. And then how do conditions of waiter jobs vary by organizational or business strategy and policy or national and state provincial context? Sorry, as I turn my head, I realize my voice is like going in and out. I'll try to fix that. Okay. So briefly on study methods, I will try to be brief, and I'm happy to talk in more detail to kind of really legitimize all of this. As I noted, for this research, I wanted to look at the two specific possible sources of variation in employment conditions for waitstaff, business strategy, public policy. To build in the comparative policy piece, I honed in on minimum wage laws, which most waiters are paid by their employers, and chose two states with different kinds of minimum wage laws, Washington and Illinois. To add a cross-national policy comparison, I also collected data from the same sites of the same chains, or sites of the same chains, pardon me, in Vancouver, British Columbia. And then focusing on restaurant chains allowed me to reasonably isolate the effects of business strategy from other kinds of industry, organization, or job-level differences between firms. So, for example, these places used all the same menus, uniforms, furniture, training materials, et cetera, within the same chain. I've given the two chains in the study the pseudonyms of Community Spot and Breakfast Place, minimally imaginative. Both are full-service, low-end chains. They operate internationally. At the time of data collection, Community Spot had about 2,000 sites in 20 countries, and Breakfast Place had about 1,305 countries. I'm hedging that a bit to maintain confidentiality. In the interest of time, I'm not going to go into too much more detail off the slide. The process of selecting the towns in which I sampled the sites was pretty multi-step and considered issues of matching geographically as well as demographically the labor forces within those and then economic conditions. Quick notes, I'm sorry. The data are from interviews with managers, semi-structured, quite detailed, conducted in the U.S. in summer of 07 and in Canada in February of 08. And here I am going to focus on the job of waiter. So now for some results. the top two lines are preamble, right? And it's, this point's been made already, that these are jobs, they're minimum wage, but these are not jobs that are primarily held by teenagers. And these are also jobs that are sticky and that people tend, in many cases, to make careers out of them, right? So as it has been a theme already this morning, we need to think about these as places where people are trying to make substantial financial contributions to their households through working in these positions. Okay. At the time of data collection, the U.S. federal minimum wage had been recently raised, as Susan mentioned, to $5.85. At that time, Washington had the highest minimum wage as a state in the country. It still does. Then it was $7.93. It's also adjusted annually for inflation, so now it's higher. The minimum wage at the time in Illinois was $7.50. It had just raised from $6.50. And then British Columbia had a minimum wage comparable to Washington. It was $8 Canadian. Now, minimum wage for tipped workers is another matter, another point of variation in policy, right? In Washington, it is one of just seven states in the country that does not have what's called a tip credit, right? So that all workers, tipped ones included, get the same minimum wage. Illinois is not that same case, right? The tip folks here get $4.50. Interestingly, when the minimum wage raised here from $6.50 to $7.50, the tipped wage did not. It remained $4.50. So they lost further ground. British Columbia, like Washington, does not have a tip credit. So everyone gets $8 an hour. Okay, so now this table summarizes the official or on-paper access of waiter jobs in the study to select fringe benefits. I think the first thing that jumps out for me, at least, makes me want to sing the Canadian national anthem. Oh, I will spare you. Is the right-hand column, right? In Canada, all four of these benefits, right, so health insurance for employees, dependents, paid vacation, paid holidays, are governmentally assured, either provided or required to be provided by employers, including 2 guaranteed weeks of paid vacation after 12 months, 9 guaranteed paid statutory holidays. Not on this slide because I... Yeah, it's on the slide. Wage reimbursed extended leave, so the parenting leave, the sick leave. 5 unpaid days of family responsibility leave, that's not even on there. And then the biggie, right? What's the biggie? The health insurance, right? So at the time, for a family of four, $110 a month. Okay, dollars. So in Canada, then, the chains don't differ in their official, in their how they officially give access to benefits because benefits are publicly assured. Right. Looking at the U.S. side, you know, the middle column there, one chain, Community Spa, provides greater access to benefits, namely employee health insurance, paid vacation. Breakfast Place, in contrast, typically offered no benefits at all. Right. So same job, being a waiter. In many cases, you know, same suburban core, right? Seattle, Chicago, Vancouver, but benefits, not benefits. Okay. I also found that discretionary practices by employers shape waiters' income and their access to benefits. With respect to income, employers could affect waiters' take-home pay in several ways, even with a mandated minimum wage in place. Right. So first, employers used tip-out rules. Right. Anyone who's been a waiter in this room, and we appreciate you, and I appreciate you greatly since the study, knows what tip-outs are, right? So this is where employers require waiters to pay a percentage of their shift sales, you know, total, to non-tipped workers or back-of-the-house staff, dishwashers, cooks, et cetera. Tip-out rules not only reduce waiter income, but they also theoretically allow employers to cross-subsidize the labor costs of back-of-the-house staff. So tip-outs can enable employers to get away with paying a lower starting wage for the non-tipped staff because effectively the waiters are paying some of their wages as well. So I expected that in sites that faced higher minimum wage wages, required tip-out percentages by employers would be higher, but I didn't find that consistently. It was true in Vancouver, where minimum wage was high relative to other provinces at the time. Tip-out requirements there were the highest in the study, ranging from 2 to 3.5%. But the Washington sites, right, which faced the highest minimum wage in the United States, had notably lower tip-out levels than in Chicago. Particularly at the Community Spot sites. The median was 1.25% in suburban Seattle versus 2.5% in Chicago, right? So higher minimum and lower tip-outs versus Chicago, way lower minimum and higher tip-outs. Okay. Second, employers varied in the hours they gave to waiters in at least two ways. First, that their use of part-time status varied by site. And second, in how many waiters they staffed shifts with, so busy shifts. slow shifts, what proportion of your wait staff do you schedule? That varied quite tremendously. That's a mixed bag, right, because the more folks you have, the easier the work is, and the more you have to share your tips, right? And then depending upon employer scheduling practices, employees may face more or less difficulty actually working in the hours they're given. That is, I observe variation across sites and the frequency of changes and staff input into scheduling. And then a final aspect of scheduling that affects income is the practice of employers sending scheduled workers home. Right, so when I polled managers about this, many acknowledge that they often send workers, waiters, home when business is unexpectedly slow or call them to not come in. Now, notably, this practice is less common in Vancouver, where they have a minimum daily pay law. So if workers are scheduled for 4 hours, they must be paid at least for two. And if they're scheduled for 8 hours, they must be paid for at least four. With respect to employer shaping benefits access, as I noted, there's the variation in employer use of part-time that affects eligibility for benefits like health insurance. And then waiting periods. The same sites offering health care and paid vacation also imposed extended waiting periods of about 12 months, which, give or take, was the median tenure in the U.S. sites. So a lot of folks never qualifying for the benefit on paper. Okay. I'm at my policy slide. How about that? Okay, so pie in the sky. So what the findings, I have to end. Oh, oops, I'm off the hook. No, a few thoughts, right, about these. This requires, I think, yeah, in all cases, tremendous political will. I think if, you know, politically we're in a good shape for that, I think economically we may not be. Higher mandated hourly pay. That's, you know, a chronic and historic theme. With noting issues of geographic variation. Issues of indexing to inflation. And then the issue of the subtraction for tips, possibly appropriate for the professional waiting jobs at high-end restaurants where folks may theoretically make $40,000, $50,000 a year, not particularly appropriate for the low-end jobs. Minimum daily pay has a benefit of really reducing employer incentives to send folks home or schedule inefficiently. Although it may lead, you know, contrarily to employers scheduling fewer folks in the first place. That obviously has negative effects for workers. And then guaranteed access to health insurance paid time off, paid time off. Certainly, and I think that's, we're all talking about that right now, and that reduces the incentive to use part-time workers who may not qualify for the health insurance. Okay, thank you very much.
Susan asked me to not try to summarize the work that all of you have presented today, because you have done a terrific job at that. So she encouraged me instead to get us started thinking about what are the lessons from this four stories about low-wage work, especially in the U.S., and another way to think of this question is, even though Anna brought us more to an international context, I think that a relevant question is to ask ourselves, are the conditions of low-wage workers just another case of, or another example of American exceptionalism? And I thought that I'd tell you a little story about a project that Russell Sage has been involved with recently that tries to place the U.S. story in a larger context. Since the 1990s, the foundation has been supporting work, research on the conditions of low-wage workers, or more specifically, less skilled workers who are in entry-level kinds of positions. And originally, we funded a series of industry-level case studies throughout the U.S., and we were trying to understand how U.S. firms were responding to competitive pressures stemming from things that you have all talked about, globalization, deregulation, technological change, and how those responses were affecting less-skilled frontline workers. There were two main findings coming out of that work. The first was that while most firms respond to economic pressures by engaging in ways of cutting costs, those resulted in the majority of the cases in the deterioration of pay and working conditions for their frontline workers. Yet a small number of firms chose other so-called high road strategies that including adopting technological innovations, offering training, engaging in attempts to identify product innovations, and those high road strategies yielded better outcomes for workers. The second finding coming out of that primarily U.S.-based study was that labor market institutions play an important role on firms' choices about how to respond to those competitive pressures. We know, for instance, that from the late 70s to the present, two significant changes in the U.S. Labor market scenario include the decline in unionization rates and the erosion of the real value of the minimum wage. And those things seem to have made it easier for firms to take the low road instead of the high road. So that employer flexibility oftentimes results in poor working conditions for a growing number of workers. But there were not enough cases of employers taking the high road for us to say something definitive about this. So we thought, what about if we have a hunch that institutions matter and that they matter significantly for the quality of work of less skilled entry-level workers, what about if we looked at other advanced industrialized economies and countries where there's enough institutional variation or to provide a contrast with the U.S. scenario? And so we identified people in primarily Western European countries that had a range of from high unemployment to low unemployment, and similar industry structures to the U.S. And we invited investigators in those places to look at jobs and industries that were low wage in the context of the U.S., to see whether or not outcomes for entry-level, less skilled workers were the same. And sort of a puzzle emerged from looking at this scenario. Other advanced industrialized countries facing similar competitive pressures showed lower incidence of low-wage work, but not necessarily, as some people thought would be the case, at the cost of lower employment rates. So we encouraged the investigators to try to explain why this difference. And they advanced two thoughts about this. Even when what happens in the workplace, the job description was oftentimes not that different, whether we were talking about nurse assistants and cleaners in hospitals or operators in call centers or cashiers at retail establishments. What mattered, there were visibly different outcomes for a worker. And one of the key things seemed to be how inclusive or not labor market institutions were. That is, whether things that had been negotiated through collective labor agreements, such as wages and benefits and working conditions, were extended to other workers in the industries where workers had less bargaining power. The other thing that they found was that low-wage workers seem to enjoy a higher quality of life in these other places, stemming from things that Anna particularly talked about in the context of Canada, the support of non-wage benefits, health insurance, sick pay, vacation and holiday paid, paid parental leave, free or low-cost quality childcare. And the other thing of this Western European scenario was a case of relative wage compression, and maybe Laura Dresser and Sheldon Danziger can later on elaborate on this. But in the context of this jobs and industries, we found that less skilled entry-level workers got relatively high pay, and the more skilled workers received a lesser pay. That if we compare it that to a similar worker in the context of the U.S., but I don't want to paint a too rosy scenario about what's going on. And the countries in question were Denmark, France, Germany, the Netherlands, and the UK, because there are changes taking place within those countries as well. The most surprising of all to the American researcher was the case of Germany, that where an increasing segment of the labor force can be considered low wage. And I won't bore you with the details about how we define low wage or not, but I wanted you to think about the descriptions of this work settings and the challenges to improve the lives of low wage workers in a larger context that is not just US-based. And I don't know if you have questions for the panelists or...
I think you were asking whether or not, like, I think you were kind of asking about the economics of how would overtime work be economically advantageous to the workplace. Is that what you were asking? Well, so I was there for 15 months, and that was already a well-established strategy. So it's not like I saw any variation in the strategy over that time. But the kind of case that I made for it was that I think it's really a part of something that I think Susan has talked about. It's really a part of being able to really flexibly manage. Because what they could do is, instead of having to hire a larger permanent staff, because this workplace offered benefits, for example, they could... And also their staffing levels depend on their resident ratio. So they have a rehabilitative unit that doesn't always have a full number of patients or residents. So they can use a kind of chronically understaffed model to work their, you know, labor costs in a way that's more advantageous to them. I also think there's another kind of slightly other way to think about it too, which is that at the time that I was doing this research, this was a pretty competitive labor market. So they actually suffer, even though these jobs have a high turnover, they actually had they were competing against a lot of other facilities, right? So one of the things, instead of actually offering higher wages, is getting a reputation for being a place that offers overtime. So that would draw workers to you. Anyway, so that's two of the ways I would think about it.
So it seems like when we're talking about low-wage jobs, we tend to identify certain sectors or certain industries, and contrasting perhaps with manufacturing in the U.S., which, you know, has historically been higher wage, you know, offered more benefits. And I was wondering if we can look historically also at how those jobs got to be better paying, and if you think that, you know, for example, with the national comparisons, it's possible for these sectors to be, you know, just as well paying as, you know, other sectors, and if we need to also look more at some of the unionization and collective bargaining power of the workers themselves in achieving those outcomes.
I have one initial thought, which is that we don't really actually have to look at history, not to, to diss historians. But Susan's study that I was a research assistant for while I was here on the study of organizational stratification that also Elaine did her project on. Its design took a set of jobs that are common not just within a given industry but across industries. So a classic example would be clerical workers, office assistants, and compared their conditions, so within the same industry, comparing firms within, but then also comparing firms operating across industries, controlling for labor market conditions because they were all in the Chicago area, and you find there tremendous variation in the conditions. So that being a secretary at an industry A firm A is not nearly as good as being at firm B at that industry, but both may be a heck of a lot worse than being at this completely other second industry, whatever firm you're in. So we find lots of contemporary, cross-sectional variation. I'm less able to speak to the historic point, but there certainly is a lot of variation, which is a negative, right? So you see bad jobs. That's depressing. But it's also, of course, this identifying points of leverage, both privately by business as well as publicly, potentially through public policy, to move the bad jobs toward the good, being more good, right, if you see that variation.
Hello. This question or comment is for Ms. Kimberly Klum. You alluded to the fact that employers use different practices to maintain cost, right? Contain costs, rather. My field relates to helping job seekers, low-income job seekers, find jobs in the retail sector. I actually work with a major retailer in Chicago, but I have since decreased my contact with them based on something they call on-call. So in the past, actually this past winter, I was approached, Alberto, can you help us find 40 to 50 people to do customer service work at our place of employment? I'm not going to name the employer. I said, great. Next question was, what are the hours? Well, they're on call, which means 0 to 40 hours. That's the trend. I've actually disconnected from that employer since that time. But I'm unsatisfied in the regard that we can enter a discussion with them via dialogue as to how we can contain their labor costs. So instead of perhaps hiring those 40 to 50 on-call positions, maybe you really need 15 to 20 people you can really count on. Mm-hmm. And I know they don't want to pay more than 20 hours because they don't want to pay benefits. Okay, so let's make it work. Let's see if we can work out 15 to 20 jobs that don't pay any more than 18 hours per week so that we can use these jobs as stepping stones. Because they're good jobs. Retail is not a loser. You can make it a winner as long as you make it win for the workers. Comments?
I'm familiar with on-call. I ran into a few of those. They're particularly the most egregious example of, 0 to 40, as you say. And yet status, full-time, part-time, whatever, has less and less meaning. A couple of the employers that I interviewed have what they call full-time flex, which means you're kind of full-time, but they have the right to make you not full-time. So status is not a very meaningful descriptor anymore of job quality. I think that your point is well taken, is that, to probe with employers why they have chosen the particular structure that they have and how it can work against them. Unfortunately, I think people who know these problems at the human resources level don't often have the voice at the higher echelons of the company. And so, they can be your allies, the people in human resources, because they understand the destructiveness of some of the practices. Unfortunately, they don't always have the power within the companies. But it's very interesting, and I think, one of the things that we need to do to equip people who are looking for jobs is to ask really probing questions. And it's hard in this economy, if you just need a job, but to ask really probing questions about what this job entails. For example, with respect to overtime is a big no-no in retail. So what they will do is ask you to work overtime on Tuesday, but then they'll cut your hours at the end of the week, so that you never really have overtime, okay? So because overtime is structured by the week, you never get that time and a half. And so there are a lot of games that get played in order to contain the cost.
I grabbed this, so I guess I'm the one. I've got the power. but I'll hand it off. I'm curious about both – in any of these retail or nursing homes or restaurants, and it sort of relates back to the question earlier about whether you found any market segment stuff. I know for a while Home Depot sort of had a high road retail reputation. Sometimes different models emerge, Costco, of course, as sort of a better end of a workforce design. Unions probably matter in nursing homes more than almost anywhere else. So I'm just than these other sectors. But I'm just curious about any stories about market segmentation or connections to unions, about disparity that you're seeing or variation that you're seeing in the sectors you study.
In the longer version of this talk, I talk about that. The two chains that I studied actually are in different market segments. Breakfast Place is in family segment, and Community Spot is in what's called casual. We can imagine what that's like. So family segment is historically associated with kind of the more or less cost minimizing, you know, cheap price. We lead on price. So lower road, lower investments in human resources. Whereas casual, again, this is, to say it's high investment is a grotesque overstatement, but nonetheless is associated with service. With a kind of an incremental improvement in service over just sheer cost in terms of restaurant product. So historically, if things were currently, you know, if that historical pattern were playing out currently, you would expect to find that in the casual segment, so the Community Spot restaurant, you would actually expect to find somewhat higher investment practices. That was a bit up for grabs at the point of the data collection, and certainly now, because with the economic and other competitive forces, restaurants in general are clamoring for business, and their strategies are beginning to blend quite a bit across segment. But that said, the findings that I posted track onto those segment differences. So Community Spot, catch, right, on paper, Community Spot provided the benefits, the health insurance, the paid days off, but of course they also used far more part-time workers. So functionally speaking, the benefits weren't accessible.
I was just going to say that, yeah, I think there also is, there are differences depending on market orientation, although those are more cloudy, I think, these days than they used to be. I do think employers who emphasize and offering expertise of some kind often do a little bit better by their workers. So their idea is not that they just have bodies staffing their stores, but they have product experts or knowledge experts. And so there's a little bit more opportunity there for people to be recognized. The sad thing is that people often do acquire knowledge and experience, but it's not recognized. Employers miss a lot of opportunities. For example, they'll ask people to be department trainers, but they don't compensate them for that extra responsibility. Or, for example, there was a woman I had interviewed at a warehouse who was the only person that knew how to run the place when the computer went down, because she had been there before the computerization. And so she was, like, critical, which apparently the computer went down quite a bit. And but she had, you know, she was not compensated in any way for that amazing knowledge in her head or the ability to keep the place running when those things happened. So there are a lot of missed opportunities for employers that I think we need to ask them questions. You know, you do ask more of people here. You are asking them to be a team lead. There's a clear distinction in this job. Why are you not making some differentiation in the way you reward them?
So I'm sorry. I have the power now. this is a question, more of a follow-up to Elaine's, and I think Jennifer's presentation earlier. You know, I think you both talked about how hard it is to convince employers, and you were alluding to getting beyond HR folks, of the efficacy of better treatment, and also how that relates to loss or gain of revenue, because that's really what floats the boat of an employer. So I'm just curious, you mentioned something about studies that demonstrate that treating these people better, paying them better, giving them better, you know, maybe training and expertise is a way to really kind of benefit the employer. Can you at least cite some of those studies or give some overview of what you found in those studies? Because that would seem to me what would be the convincer of employers.
I'll be talking a little bit about this later this afternoon, but there's quite a lot of data that points to the business payoff of an engaged workforce, that and employee engagement has many facets, a lot of which have to do with fair employment, frankly, and the opportunity to learn in the job, to develop internally, opportunity to have an impact on your work environment, have a say, and increasing pattern of teamwork is creating that, structuring work around teams so that people, even at the lowest level, have an opportunity to say something about their work experience. The big thing that I take from what you all are saying is that the employers that you've been citing tend to be looking short-term, tend to be looking at cost-benefit in a only labor perspective and not connecting their business outcomes, whether it's growth or profitability long-term, employee retention, which is a major cost savings when you hold on to employees, and defining their profitability in a broader sense. That is precisely the sort of thing that Winning Workplaces has set out to do, draw attention to that, and I'll be talking a little bit about some employers this afternoon that we've identified as outstanding workplaces that are investing in employees, even low-wage workers.
And I just want to say that City Sales actually is one of those companies that recognizes that those critical factors to engagement drive business outcomes, and that's part of the reason why we wanted to try to deconstruct their culture and understand it. But you're exactly right. It's about these critical organizational factors, and I'd be happy to share with you references, but it's kind of crossing over into the business literatures. Yeah. One of the things that came out of the City Sales study is we created a toolkit for businesses, kind of applied research. I mean, I've got it if anyone wants it. But the idea is to use rigorous research methodology and then translate it into usable issue briefs as a way to begin to get the information out. So that was a big push.
Since we're here at a School of Social Work, let me raise the question, what's the role of social workers in all this? We come in contact in our various work with almost every low-wage worker, and they have not been helped to be advocates for themselves, to understand their rights, to understand how unions might support them. And what's our job as social work educators and as social work providers to begin to turn this around from the labor supply side as well as the demand side of the equation?
Can I just answer? Go ahead. Well, I'm not sure that this isn't maybe what you were looking for as an answer, and I don't mean to steal Roberta Iverson's thunder, but to kind of also link it back to what Aixa was saying, I think that part of it is that we need to also remind each other and remind business or remind our public policymakers that this none of these things can be talked about in isolation, right? So it's not just about restructuring these jobs, because I actually think that there's a limit to how much you can actually restructure because I feel like the jobs that I was studying actually were kind of a best case scenario, because unless you're going to radically restructure the wages that are being offered in these jobs don't have any internal occupational mobility. So even when you're providing kind of relatively good benefits to them, they can only provide so much income. But for example, housing, we've completely decimated our public housing supports, and without more affordable housing, I don't think you can have a conversation about kind of labor and labor policies.
A few thoughts about social work. First of all, you know, in the social work schools, we graduate a lot of people who do things like job development or work support activity, and I think it's very important for them to understand the nature of work better. And so I think some of the work that's being done here at U of C, for example, with Susan and Julie, for people to understand what it is really you're dealing with on the other side is very, very important. I think social work should be even more involved in community organizing from a personal standpoint. I think the card check legislation could be a great convincer of business when data is not available. If you make, you know, retail is a largely non-union industry, and I think it shows considerably. So I think that is a role for social work, is to look for ways in which to apply pressure from below. And then I think, I don't know, I think it would be very interesting for partnerships to evolve between social work and business schools, or, you know, try to put all the people in the same room who have an interest in this, so that we're not the, you know, we end up sometimes being the silo, like the HR people end up being the silo. You know, we're the people who have a perspective on the human experience and who are invested in that, but you gotta somehow get to the lever of power. And that's an important thing, too, for social work to be connected into those other aspects.
The thing for us to note quickly, of course, is that Shelley Acabas is uniquely poised to answer her own question because she is in charge of a program on the world of work at Columbia that trains MSW-level social workers to understand deeply what work is, the ramifications of it for at the individual level, what policy can do to respond to it. I mean, obviously social work, because of the micro-macro spectrum that we target and train students in, we should be able to convey to them whether they're going to go out and primarily work at the individual level. They should understand how policy interacts with work and not be trying to, you know, kind of dust off and pump up individual workers to uniquely themselves handle conditions that are fundamentally not workable. And then conversely, we send out policy folks, and we need to have them trained to think about policies that can be, you know, targeted effectively to enhance the quality of work and support workers in their work lives. And then, of course, administration management level folks who go into, in some cases, for-profit corporate settings and maybe the EAP or other HR heads who have these insights as well. So.
Yeah, well, I was curious for each of you, actually, what the profit margin was with the firms that you studied.
Tiny, 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 tiny. Very, I mean, restaurants are fractional. They're kind of, all the managers were breathless, nearly. So I also studied rural independent sites and urban independent sites and suburban independent sites, and they just, you could kind of hear the panic in their voices, or so they felt, at least. So really, in terms of this long-range, short-range issue, I think whether it's kind of a technical assistance need to some extent, but combined with real competitive realities, and they were feeling like, oh, this is absolutely the best that I can do. So, questionable.
I would just like to ask, it seems that all of you had pretty significant access to the employees and the companies that you, and the businesses that you studied. And I'm just wondering, what incentive was there for these businesses? What did they hope to get out of the research that you were doing? Why would they let you in and interview and survey their employees? I'm wondering what they hope to get out of this.
For city sales, kind of the incentive for them was, and it was two-tiered. One is that they were going to get additional information beyond the 24 questions that they normally get when they survey their employees. And for us, quite frankly, the timing was right. They wanted to do a survey within the regions in which we wanted to pursue. So it was kind of timing, but they were also hoping that our research would inform some of their supervisory practices, which did go on, and we did help to inform that.
I wanted to get back to your profit margin question real quick, which is that in retail it's also considered to be fairly thin, although I would argue these are all large publicly traded companies. Somebody's making some money. On the question of employer access, I'm always amazed, actually, at how much people like to talk about what they do. And, you know, if you're willing to give them anonymity, they're really very anxious, particularly people in the HR world, really very anxious to have an ear for, you know, they know, and they like exploring that and hearing about what others are doing. You know, I think the trickiest thing is getting permission at the higher levels, and in most cases I think anonymity is critical for that. I have to say that I think it would be harder now. When we did our study, it was 2003. I think it would be harder now, you know, in this economy. I think employers are much more guarded.
I have a question about the role of technology, especially in this economy, and how, I mean, I guess I see the potential of it going the other way.
It's funny, in retail, you could see it two ways. One, a lot of people who are in the warehouse, who would typically be, like, you know, literally manual labor unpacking and moving, were all of a sudden using, like, scanners. And so they needed more technological knowledge. But they would argue that it made the job more boring and made it more error-prone because nobody paid attention to the labels or anything anymore. They were just you know, relying on the technology. So I think there was both upskilling and deskilling going on, and it's not clear, you know, it would need to be unpacked more. I think for the most part, a lot of times technology is a mixed bag for them because most of these folks like to use their brains. And so, and they talk a lot about, you know, liking to have expertise and being recognized for that and being able to puzzle things out. And to the extent that, you know, store display is now all computerized, you know, that for them was less gratifying.
In terms of technology, I mean, one of the, I think, things that we're learning from a bunch of studies is that technology is a tool. And sometimes employers implement it in ways that improve the quality of jobs, and other times it's used to de-skill jobs. And so there's this great book, Low Wage Work, put out by the Russell Sage Foundation, which looks at industry transformations in different industries, in banking and in different services industries. And one of the key examples is that, like in banking, the same technology came down. You know, you get a screen when you call for customer service. Now, some banks implemented that so that they really stratified their workforce and the calls would come in and people's jobs were really de-skilled. Other banks used that as an opportunity to improve the skills of their customer service representatives so that when you call in, there's a bunch of information on the screen that says, you know, what's your balance? How should they treat you? You know, my brother would say, I can call up the bank and I'll ask for late fees taken away. I talk them into it. And I think, no, they're looking at your balance. Me, I got to pay the late fees, you know, no matter what my argument but with the person. But, you know, so I think this idea of that technology is driving this downward spiral in quality of jobs, or that it's increasing the skill level are part of the questions that we should be asking now. And especially as technology moves forward, right, it's really an opportunity. As there's changes, it's often easier to change things when there's a change, right, than taking jobs as they exist and try to improve them. So anyways, I thank the panel. This is fantastic.